On the home stretch is another very useful panel, which is called Beyond Books. Fremantle Press CEO Jane Fraser is with panellists Alison James, Polly Lowe and Tamron Bennett.
Welcome everyone again. In this session Beyond Books, we're going to explore opportunities and pathways that writers can consider in publishing their work other than the traditional book route. As CEO of the press, a lot of my work involves promoting our books outside the Australian traditional book trade with film, TV, radio, stage productions or audiobooks, and into books for people with reading disabilities, so such as large format or braille, and of course in translation through international rights sales. So I do a lot of that and it's all very exciting. So the work that these three are involved in is familiar territory for me too. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce our panellists who look at writing in ways that are far from the traditional print and bound copies we find on our bookshelves. And using the collective knowledge of the panel, this session is about other pathways writers can consider for publishing their work. We may explore how they might go about writing specifically for those pathways and what skills may be needed to develop and how to present writing to those relevant groups. So on my left is Alison James. She's the award-winning writer and director of a short fiction film, Judas Collar, which is screening at the Perth Festival tomorrow afternoon. She has a background as a writer and director of documentary, TV series and short films. Judas Collar was developed and produced with support from Screen West and No Thing Production Company. Next to Alison is Polly Lowe, who's the literary director of the Black Swan State Theatre Company. And she has an extensive background working on script development in everything from adapting existing novels to stage to creating completely new scripts. And at the end is Tamron Bennett, who is a poet and artist, as well as director of Red Room Poetry, which seeks to make poetry a meaningful part of everyday life. Their projects include putting poetry on trains, planes, coffee cups, street banners, murals, seed packets, and creating poetic pathways through the gardens of King's Park to deepen our creative and cultural connections with nature. So, let's go. I thought we'd start off with a brief icebreaker. Although it's probably not going to be brief, because I'm really going to ask you about each of your backgrounds and how does writing the way that you do it differ to how you understand writing for books is. Does it start with an ability to write a book, like we all do, or does it require a completely different skill set and therefore specialist training? So what kind of journey have each of you had to get you where you are now?
Studied at Curtin University and I wanted to be a drama director, but I made a documentary in my final year and fell in love with that. And over a series of years, I worked in docos, kind of working my way up the chain. I ended up being the series director of a hit TV show called Outback Truckers. You've probably all seen it. No, you won't have ever seen it. Which was a really, I kind of just found myself there. And then after directing 32 episodes of a male format skewed show, I kind of realised, what am I doing? I was actually going to be working on a new series, which was about helicopters in the outback, and I came across this story about a camel and fell in love with it, and the next day I quit my job and started being a writer. So it was a really kind of unconventional path, I guess, but I think in terms of writing for screen, you've just got to love films. It's such a specific medium that if you haven't watched a lot of films, if you don't love films, you're not going to be interested in writing for the screen. So I don't think it requires an ability to write books. I've never written books, but I think it definitely requires a love of story and a love of writing, whether that's just writing down whatever thoughts or whether it's writing stories or just telling a yarn down at the pub. That's that part of it has to be there.
Polly?
Oh, I've had a very long journey because I'm a lot older than everybody here. I started off my professional life as a performer, so I'm an actor originally. I still do performance work, but I have come around more and more through. I started doing some writing as well, but now I do a lot of dramaturgy work. And I've seen a lot of eyes glaze over immediately. I said that word because I know a lot of people don't have any idea about what a dramaturg is and what a dramaturg does. We're quite invisible in the industry still, and probably always will be, because we do work in the background. I spend a lot of my time working with playwrights on developing the script. So a good dramaturg will ask a lot of questions. And the sort of questions that will make a playwright go, oh, yes, I hadn't thought about that, and go a bit deeper into what they were considering and look a bit wider and a bit further as well. I guess, in a way, having a dramaturg is like having a really knowledgeable best friend. So it's somebody who understands how theatre works and understands how scripts work and will ask all the questions because they're interested in getting you to write the best play that you possibly can and the play that you want to write.
Oh, that's an editor.
Yeah.
And where you are now, and have you...
Okay, so I work 2 days a week at Black Swan as the literary director there, and I freelance for 3 days. So I also work with other companies. I'm working with Yuriyakon also at the moment, and I'm also working with a couple of people freelance who are developing their own projects. I quite often just work with writers who want a little bit of dramaturgical input and freelance around quite a lot. And for me, I actually think that writing books doesn't mean that you'll automatically be a good script writer at all, and vice versa. Because the novelist gives us the knowledge of the inner and outer world of a character through written dialogue woven together with really clever and evocative descriptions of a character's inner and outer worlds. Yeah. On stage, the playwright's character's inner and outer worlds need to be revealed through active spoken dialogue. So it's quite a different process, a different way of thinking, a different lot of techniques that you bring into play, I think, when you're working on script writing as opposed to writing a book.
Tamron?
My pathway into being a poet, and I don't know how many poets are in the room here today, but I think of poetry as lots of different things, definitely not what lives in books. So when I was young, I was deaf, I couldn't hear, so my first language is visual, and that led to me creating and collaborating with a lot of visual artists through my life. So the pathway for doing what I do at Red Room Poetry and the way that I became a poet is just seeing the world differently, and I imagine most of you in this room are seeing the world differently through your process as a writer. So collaboration has been a huge part of my work as a poet, as a visual artist, and then also at Red Room Poetry, we create through partnerships with poets, with communities, and then find also our supporters for our work in partnership with places like art galleries, parks, gardens, publishers, councils, all kinds of sponsors, sometimes seed companies. They're sponsoring some of what we do in Kings Park at the moment.
Great, lovely. And the next question is a bit about, I guess, for you, the audience, to think about how you write and how you want your audiences to respond to your writing. In a way, when we write books, the reader conjures up their own world in response to that writing. So how do you go about your work on stage or screen or in poetry and make sure that the audience see the interpretation that you want them to, as opposed to, say, a writer of fiction or poetry? And I guess it's really, this is a question for you, Polly, to start with, and Alison as well.
Okay. When you're writing a novel, you have complete control over the whole world. What a fabulous thing. So it's up to you to let us know about your characters. What we learn about them is completely up to you. You tell us what they think and what they feel and even how they clean their teeth if you want to. With a play, it's both a frightening and an exciting experience to hand your play over to a production team. The temptation for a writer can be to write in every actor direction and stage direction they could possibly think of to try and control that still. But the joy is in letting go of some of that and in focusing on active dialogue, getting the journey working well, and then giving it over to your director, your actors, your designers, and allowing them then to bring their interpretation to your script. Yeah, it's scary, but this is the fabulous thing about theatre, is that it's a collaborative process once it goes into production. Yeah? Suddenly you're part of a group of people. You've done all this work on your own, or a fair bit of it on your own. You may have had some input at various stages of that writing process, but a lot of it's been done on your own, but now you're part of a team. And that team, their whole goal is to make your work for an audience. And sometimes a production company or production may bring things to your script that you weren't particularly wanting. And sometimes they may bring things to your script that you hadn't even thought of, that just blows your mind. So it's a little bit of a gamble, but what a joy that is to be able to hand this over and then see it come to life in the hands of people whose sole aim is to make this work in the best way that they possibly can for you and for that audience.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I think in stage and screen, the script is not only a story and you want it to have an emotional resonance with the reader and really to engage your audience ultimately, but it's a real technical document. And so it's the guide for hair and makeup, wardrobe, lighting, camera. So when you're writing for screen, you're not only trying to put the audience in the best seat of the house, but you're also throwing little clues to the entire team that's going to be realising this project. So ultimately, when you're writing a novel, you can say someone might be uptight, and we instantly get what that means. But for a screenplay, if you can't see it or hear it, it shouldn't really be in there. So for using that uptight example, you know, you might say that your character has, you know, her hair pulled back in a tight bun, or that she's wearing, a creaseless power suit, or that she's clicking her pen during the meeting. And all of those things indicate hair and makeup, wardrobe, sound, camera. So you're really throwing clues not only to the audience but to your technical team that's going to bring that off the page.
I actually have got this great thing that I found online. It's a little quote in an article written by somebody called Kirk Lynn, who I've got no idea who he is, but it's a little bit slick, but it's a really interesting consideration and a really interesting provocation, which says, if you want to know the difference between a script and a play, try eating a recipe.
That's good. It's interesting you say that, because we at Fremantle Press, we've had a number of books that have either gone to film or have been adapted for the stage. And just recently I went to a workshop with some WAPA students, and they are working on an adaptation of The Hope Fault, which is written by a West Australian writer here, Tracy Farr. And it was amazing to see the adaptation, because the characters, there were twice as many characters or actors on the stage as there were in the book, but they're all taking different roles of different things that went to layer the storytelling. And it was done in such a completely visual, sound, everything way that was so different to reading the book. But the same message was conveyed, the same story was conveyed, and it was just breathtaking, knowing the book so intimately and then seeing it on the stage. It was just terrific.
Okay. I did the same thing with Lighthouse Girl as well.
And with Lighthouse Girl, we talked about that earlier, Polly. Yeah. Yes, Lighthouse Girl, Lighthouse Boy, written by Diane Wolfer, who lives in Albany, and was brought out on stage by the Black Swan State Theatre Company a couple of years ago.
Written by Helly Turner. Yeah. Adapted by Helly Turner.
And that took a long time to...
It took... Yeah, it was... The whole process would have been about 3 years. We actually took a development of it down to Albany about a year before it went on stage eventually, and it had already been in development for quite a long time before that. And I guess adaptations are really interesting and difficult beasts to consider, because with any adaptation, you need to find the central dramatic question of a book. And you also need to do that with a play. What's the central dramatic question? What's the unanswerable that you're trying to explore in this script? And then find the way that you can actively tell that story through active dialogue and through conflict. Plays are driven by conflict, and I don't mean fisticuffs here. I'm talking about, okay, so at the beginning of a play you have a balance of some sort, which doesn't mean that everything's nicely balanced. It can be sort of balanced and unevenly balanced in any way. And into that balance, something comes and shifts that. There's an inciting incident that throws that balance out of balance, out of the balance it's been in. And the rest of the play is really about trying to find a new balance, trying to find where that balance can... And things get in the way of that. There are obstacles and things that oppose that, and that's where your conflict is, and that's what drives the story and drives the play.
And adapting a book that takes you many hours to read into a play that's 2 hours long is... Oh, I can't imagine how... Or even a film, you know, you have to get the essence of it. Tamarin, we don't really imagine writing as a commodity, but the Red Room poetry is turning poetry into an everyday part of life, with poems, as you said, on seed packets and keep cups, buses, trams and murals. How can writers expand their notions of where to find or writing or to be a writer, do you think?
So I think that idea comes from publishing in unusual and unexpected ways, because there are organisations and companies that are publishing in traditional formats and they're doing that incredibly well. So what Red Room Poetry tries to do is find those gaps, and potentially as authors in the room, what you might also be looking for are gaps in the market. And I guess that operates on a small level as well. So how might you be able to publish your poetry on a seed pack or a cup or a shirt or a different platform? Might you be using Instagram or some of the social channels that were spoken about before to be able to put yourself out there in a small way and test your market? And for us, what we do at Red Room Poetry, publishing in these platforms, is something that other literary organisations might not always be doing, or they might be using that as a marketing tool. For us, we commission poets to really break that notion of where you would find poetry. Poetry has a really, of course, strong tradition of publishing in books, but for my own interest and background, it has a whole other world that it can be living in. And we were talking about quotes, I think, and one of my favourites is that Cecilia Vicuña, she says, "Once I dream of a form of poetry made by the sound of feet walking through grass." Where can poems be? What can they be? And for us, that's a question that we're always asking at Red Room Poetry. Where could we put those poems, and what do people really experience as the poem? So we're working in galleries to perform those poems, and really questioning how far we can push that in partnership. We work with Val Morgan to screen student poems as part of our poetry object competition. We work with national galleries and museums across the country. So it's really about starting that conversation about where a poem might live and how they might, those institutions might publish those poems within them. So sometimes those poems are living in vitrines as part of an exhibition, or going on to live in the garden as part of poetic pathways and signage.
Can I ask you the mechanics of actually getting poetry on seed packets? Or who do you partner with? How does that conversation start?
So the conversation, yeah, we really go into those conversations not so much anymore with a preconceived project, like this is what we want to do. We go in there with the conversation of what's the gap, what's missing in your program, and how might we be able to work with you to do that? Because if you're there with a partner and you're helping to solve a gap and work collectively rather than saying this is what I want, this is the outcome that I imagine, then it's a lot more collaborative.
And because they'd ask for money, assuming, you know, they'd say, well, you pay for it.
More often than not, it comes out the other way.
Wonderful. Yeah,
that Red Room is in partnership and the poets are being paid. That's what we're advocating for at all times, that poets are paid for their work, not just because they love it. And we worked with the Seed Bank in Sydney to create those seed packs originally. So their seed collectors are really excited to be able to choose the right seed to match this particular poem. So it's about getting that organisation to become a part of your story and take them on the journey. Today in our event, we also had Luke Swedman, the seed collector at Kings Park Botanic Garden, as one of the poets. So how can you bring all of that together?
Are those the kind of projects, and just going back to the first panel session, that you could get Australia Council funding for, or things like that? Would you ever consider that?
Absolutely.
I mean, I imagine that would be possible?
Yep. So Red Room Poetry, we're lucky enough to have four-year funding from the Australia Council, right. Create New South Wales, and like I said, there's over 81 partners that we work with across the country and all levels of government support the projects.
You just have to have great ideas, just make them happen. Wow. Okay, so Alison, back to you. Can you tell us about the things that you have to consider when you write a script for screen? You know, the challenges that you've got.
Yes. Well, I think the biggest challenge is that it's one page is 1 minute of screen, which is like, oh, great, it's only 90 pages for a feature, easy. But it's really hard to condense a lot of things that you want to say into such a short amount of words. So you have to be, I think, really economical with your writing and start the scene later than you might think and leave earlier than you might think as well. And it's, I think, about finding the core of each scene and what the scene does. And I think each scene you want to be either advancing the plot, the character, or the theme. And if it's not doing two of those three things, then it's probably not going to make it in the film. So that's a kind of a little check that I like to do. But I think it ultimately comes down to how good is your ending. And if you're tossing up a bunch of different story ideas, I always think just pick the one with the best ending, because it's, you can fill in some other things, but if you haven't got that ending, if you aren't going to take that audience on a really emotional journey, it's 2 years of your life minimum on a feature. Is it worth it for that? So I think the other thing I find challenging
actually,
that's
about really it. It's just that whole thing of the story petering out at the end. Yes. Because the, yes. And so quite often too, you'll find writers have false endings because they're not quite sure if you've got what they wanted you to say it.
Yes.
As well.
So, well, it's interesting as well, because in a novel, the ending can be a little less clear than on screen, because you're reading it over a series of days or weeks, and you can be taking in all of these different things, the ending doesn't have to be as amazing. If that sounds really patronising, I'm not meaning it that way. But what I mean is, if you're in a cinematic experience, you've paid money, you're there for 90 minutes, we live in a really busy world, and so you want to come out having been moved. You want to have gone on an emotional experience, whether that's just for pure romance or fun and adventure or serious drama. Going on an emotional ride is why we tell stories. So the absolute hardest part about writing is writing. Doesn't matter what you're writing in, I think.
And I imagine with film, it's not like a book or a novel where you can keep writing and go back and fix it and on the fly almost to the last minute, whereas you've got to have it all done before filming starts. You can't start, yes. Oh, no, let's rewrite that section or else it gets
absolutely
costly.
So you'll go through many, many drafts when writing for screen, and even before it gets funded, you know, you're talking about at least 6, 7, 8 drafts. Before you show it to anyone, you'll probably have done 3 or 4. But with each draft, I guess you're kind of crystallising what your story is about. And for me, sometimes the theme of the piece doesn't necessarily make itself clear straight away. And although I use index cards and I plot and I work out, you know, what's my midpoint, what's my second act break, I have all of those structural things in place, I might not find the true heart of the story until I've been through a couple of drafts, and then I realise, oh, this is why this isn't working, because it's not really about this, it's about this. So yeah, I think that's what makes writing interesting and dynamic, is because you're trying to find it, and that's part of what makes me show up on the page, really, is kind of going through that journey with my characters and trying to work out what they want and why they want that and why I want them to want it. So for me, that's where the love of it comes in.
It's very similar to all writing. Okay, now, Polly, what about the difference between screenwriting and stage writing? And you could probably both talk to this about the difference between the
absolutely.
Two.
Absolutely. I think looking at some of the things that are the same as well, just to start off with, is really interesting, is because both forms allow the audience to experience the same story at the same time. That's pretty amazing. That's a pretty amazing community thing to be able to have. And both forms have what you were talking about, that limited time to tell a story in. So the story needs to be told concisely. You need to make choices on how to do this best. And you need, in that case, to use your technique and your skill and your imagination. Get the vision of how to take the audience on the most interesting journey possible. That's what you want. Unlike film, theatre is live. And this makes it truly exciting and dynamic as far as I'm concerned. The actor affects the audience and the audience affects the actor. So every performance is slightly different. So your experience at the theatre is unique and will never be repeated. So that's pretty amazing. That's a pretty amazing thing to be able to have. The limitations of stage also stretch the imagination of the writer and of the creative team. How do we tell the story in this space and have the strongest, most dynamic effect that we can have? A film can travel to multiple places to make the film, have all these fabulous locations that they go to. What happens in a play must be able to be created for that stage and that space. So it can still travel through different places and times and seasons and whatever, but we need to find more creative ways of doing it rather than having the real thing, which is beautiful and gorgeous and the camera takes you there. Quite often you'll find that stage scenes are longer than film scenes because of that very thing. They don't tend to travel around so much to so many locations. But some plays do travel to a number of locations, and those plays usually in that case will have a representative sketch set rather than a naturalistic set. Screen, the camera guides what the audience sees. So the camera focuses the eye, I would say, and it's a beautiful visual medium. It can give you close-ups and, you know, great long tracking shots and jump cuts and all sorts of amazing things that it can do. Really helps to tell that story. On stage, the writer has to find the way to reveal the story and character through action and dialogue. So if I've just gone, a camera can come in and go, that's what she's reading. A stage audience can't. So the writer then has to find not the most obvious way to let the audience know what's on this paper, but the most interesting way to let the audience know what's on this piece of paper. Another thing that I will just mention that is different is that on film you can have lots of extras. You can have someone that sells flowers on the side of the road, and you employ them for a couple of hours in the morning, and then you don't have to employ them again. They've been and gone. You can't do that on stage, because if you have someone coming to sell flowers every night and then disappear, you've still got to pay them for rehearsal, and you've got to pay them for every performance they come to if you're doing professional theatre. So you don't write extras in. Every character needs to have a dynamic reason for being on the stage. And that doesn't mean you can't write small characters, because small characters can be some of the most interesting characters that you write. But make them interesting. Make them interesting not only for the sake of the theatre company and its money, but for the sake of the actor. Give the actor something fabulous to work with. Sometimes there are a number of small roles in a play. And if the play is fantastic enough and somebody really desperately wants to do it, they will still do it, but quite often they will make actors double. So you've got actors playing a number of different roles in those sorts of scenarios. Do you think of any other differences?
Yeah, I mean, with film, you want to put the audience in the best seat of the house in every shot. So it is that ability to get up close or to stay far away or to drone up and see an incredible vista. It's to take them into other worlds that they might not have seen or might not be able to see. The film that I'm talking here at the Perth Festival about is a film called Judas Collar, which is a film that takes the perspective of a camel. So it's a live action film that is shot with a cast of 8 camels. We trucked 8 camels and a helicopter 1,000 kilometres up north and filmed it. It's not something that you could do on a stage necessarily.
No. And there are some ideas that are obviously for a certain medium, and that's so obviously a film. As soon as you hear it, you just go, film, it's written all over it.
And I think it's about capturing the emotion of those big cinematic moments, like battle scenes or quiet moments that you just wouldn't be able to connect with. So, yeah, I think it just comes back to the location and putting the audience in the best seat of the house.
I think that goes to talking about what is adaptable too. If somebody's written a work of fiction, not every work of fiction, in fact, most of them are not appropriate for film or for stage then in that sense, would they be? Mm. Well, we were talking about this earlier, Polly.
Yeah.
You know, why would you adapt something for the stage if it works well in a book, but it, you'd have to really work it hard to make it work on the stage? So
it has to be something that grabs the imagination of a yes. theatre maker or a...
Yes.
Or a
you know, not necessarily a blockbuster book is appropriate for film or stage and vice versa. So, Tamron, with The Red Room making poetry easy to consume with projects like Poetic Moments, New Shoots and The Disappearing, can you tell us a bit more about those projects and what writers need to do to get involved in that sense?
So two of those projects that you mentioned are always open for submission. The Disappearing is a project that maps poetry to place, and it's concentrating on vanishing or disappearing, changing places. So you can just search Red Room Poetry, The Disappearing, and it's always open for submissions. So you can pin your own poems to a place that's changing. It's like an alternative travel guide of what you can't see anymore. So those sites that no longer exist, that's one way to participate immediately. The other one is the Garden of Poems that I mentioned, New Shoots, that's been growing in the mangroves of Sydney Olympic Park. It's been growing at the Royal Botanic Gardens of Sydney, Melbourne and now Kings Park. It's always open for submissions as well. So if you've got a poem inspired by plants, feel free to send that to us. And then for poets that are interested in being commissioned, they can always send us a short suite of their poems, their CV, and areas that they're interested to work in as well. And they're always considered when we're going into the next round of commissioning. So Red Room Poetry is the largest commissioner of Australian poetry. So if you are a poet or there's snippets of poetry within the novels or other mediums that you're writing in, then consider submitting a poem to us or sharing a suite of poetry. So that's some of the ways that people can participate.
And also you're developing poetry in language as well, Indigenous languages. So
that's
from Australia-wide, isn't it?
That's right. At the moment it was piloted in New South Wales and led by a member of our team, Curly Saunders, who's also a children's book author with the book Incredible Freedom Machines. And Curly is a young Kaurna woman who... We have a very collaborative process at Red Room Poetry, which is projects are led by people. There are also concepts and context for us when it comes to a poem, but it's always about the people behind the project, their energy and their passion. And Curly's passion is coming from a family with a long history of displacement, how she was missing language. She was on the banks of the Shoalhaven River before she joined our team doing a residency, and she could hear these voices of what she knew to be ancestors but didn't know what they were saying. So her journey has been finding out what they are saying and really wanting to open up that opportunity for other First Nations poets who might be in a similar place to her. So the project's called Poetry in First Languages, and we work with also mentors through that process, looking at a lot of research behind that, finding out that young First Nations people were only spending up to 1 hour a week with an elder. So those connections were being lost. So the program is all about writing on country and those poets going through the journey too before we engage students. Along that path. So those poems have also been published in partnership with organisations like Lendlease. So Lendlease were looking at how they could bring First Nations languages, it being the year of International Year of Indigenous Languages, how they could bring that into public spaces and make people more aware of that. And Lendlease did a series of light boxes that meant poets like Ali Kobiekem and Lorna Munro, Joel Davison, they were all commissioned and had their works published in these platforms. And those poems were also then put on trains throughout the city. And so poems in language, they'll also be at Taronga Zoo. And hopefully that's beginning to build our relationship as part of a new project called Extinction Elegies. And all of these only happen in partnership and in conversation with other organisations. Yeah.
Wonderful. That's great. Let's hope it happens here sooner rather than later.
Yes, it does.
Last question with the Black Swan and Red Room. What, and also for you too, Alison, what sort of writing do you look for when developing your programs? Long-term planning. And how can writers adapt their work to be used for the purposes that you might have in mind? Like, how can writers develop their skills to be used by you?
For writers starting out in screenplays, I guess it's very much just looking for things that can be filmed. And that sounds funny to say, but there are a lot of screenplays that I read that can't really be filmed necessarily. But I think it's also just connecting with other writers at this stage. It's the great thing about screenplays is that there's, if you've got a great screenplay, it will find filmmakers. But it's, I think, mostly about just writing a good screenplay, which is just the hardest thing on earth.
Would Screen West be a good place to start? Do they accept submissions like a traditional publisher would? Is that how they
operate? Yes. So Screen West don't. Screen West is the state funding agency for film, and they don't accept screenplays because they don't actually commission films. But what they do is facilitate some emerging filmmaker initiatives. One of the things that you could be involved with is a group called the Game Changers. I think it's called the Pinnacles WA, which is a group of the Australian Writers Guild, the Australian Directors Guild, and a group called the Game Changers, which is like emerging filmmakers. And they have events where we get together and meet each other. So if you're a young writer, you want to meet young directors or established directors and really get to network and find out what kind of stories that they're interested in is one avenue. But really, I think it's about telling a story that you're passionately wanting to tell. And if you're passionate enough about it, then it will find the right person.
Yeah, I think that's something that's big for me too. I think write what you want to write, not what you think others want you to write. That's always a big thing for me. Because so many times I get things from writers who have written things that they think we would be interested in rather than what they are interested in. And what we are actually looking for, I think, is when we're putting together programs and so on in this industry, is we're looking for an irresistible script. And we don't know what that is until we read it. Because if we did, we'd tell you what it was and you'd go away and write it for us. All of our lives would be a lot easier then. But we rely on the genius of writers to surprise and delight and inspire us. That genius usually comes from a fire in here. So that's what we want you to find. And when you bring that to us, then we'll be going, oh, heck, how can we not do this play? How can we do it? Or whatever. There are a number of practical things on the way to that. Is that all right for me to go ahead and just... I'd say, firstly, make sure you know the medium you're writing for really well. The number of plays I've read over my time, and I've asked the writer, how many plays have you seen? And they'll go, none. And you just go, you need to see plays, you need to read plays, you need to understand plays if you're going to be able to write a play. Know your medium. There are workshops sometimes that crop up. Keep your ears open for what's going on. What opportunities are around. Check out support and development opportunities offered by places like Playwriting Australia. They've actually just put out their new program, script development program, which I've got a copy of here, looking at things like new scripts, scripts that are ready for a roundtable discussion, scripts that are just ready for, because the writer feels stuck, they need to have a bit of a jab along and let's talk about this and see what's going on here. So they've got programs for scripts at all sorts of stages, so check them out. Places like the Blue Room also. The Blue Room is there doing new plays all the time, and they quite often have little programs, or they have had script writing workshops as well. So just keep your eyes open for those sorts of things. They're always used. It's great to go into those workshops even when you know a bit. I've actually been teaching some playwriting workshops for the last few years for Yiriyarkin, for First Nation workshops. And there's one writer in particular who started coming along 4 years ago, and she's come along every year. Her second play was produced at the Fringe Festival last year. her first play we are currently in development with, and it is going to open at Yerriyarkin Theatre in May. So going to these workshops, she comes back every year after year, because even though she's done the workshops before, she just finds that it centres her and it helps her to focus and reminds her of the techniques that she needs to write a play. Writers Guild, they used to offer script assessments. I don't know if they still do or not. Check it out. I don't even know if they've still got an office locally, have they, the Writers Guild?
No, not anymore.
Oh, okay.
Do you know, I went into ScreenWest for funding recently to try to get some money for a script that I was working on, and the development manager there said, never underestimate your ability to do this yourself. And I said, does that mean I'm not getting any money? And he was like, well, you could. You could put in for funding. You could write the application. You could go through and spend all this time on that, or you could just write it. And I thought, yes, actually, rather than doing this application and putting all my energy into writing the greatest application that ever lived, I'm just going to actually sit down and write it. And it was a great piece of advice. And that, you know, there's so much information. If you want it, it's on the web. Everything's on the web. But don't underestimate your ability to do it yourself.
And once you've got it to that stage also, there are other funding opportunities that open up for you as well, aren't there? For then getting it onto the next step.
Exactly.
And starting to get it produced. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah,
thanks, Polly. I think we've heard the bell, so I'm going to have to wrap it up. I'm sorry, I haven't left any time for questions, but if you do have questions of the panel, please, we've finished almost, so please ask afterwards. If you'd join me in thanking Alice and Polly and Tamron.
Thank you.